How good does that coffee look? Seriously. I've mentioned before, Australia coffee culture. It is a big, big thing down here. Just before I drink any more of that wonderful latte, that's what it looks like. So it is a big, big thing. And one of the first things I did when I moved into this house, which was no longer an easy walk to the shops compared to where I used to live in Sydney, was get a good coffee machine. Mm. That is, I can't remember if that was a tax deduction or not, but that is one of the best things I've done for my productivity here. So g'day to people joining in. I can see the comments there. What's the weekly update going to be about? Well, I kind of gave a little bit of it away on the tweet, and there's going to be a lot of IoT stuff. There's going to be some other things related to data breaches. Have I been pwned? People will raise some random things. There's always random things. But something less random is sponsor. There's always a sponsor. And I do try to talk about the sponsors first these days. And the sponsor this week is a very, very good fit to Have I Been Pwned, which is safepass.me. So SafePass has been a sponsor there for a few different episodes now. And a big thanks to them for joining in. They are helping make credential stuffing a thing of the past because it is one of the biggest threats to organizations. This is a good sponsor to have because I'm very, very endorsing that message. Find out how to protect your network right now at safepass.me. So they build tools that help you find things like bad passwords that people in your organization might be using and try and stop them from hopefully using them in the first place. So again, very analogous to Have I Been Pwned. I'm actually going to talk about some more pwned passwords related stuff in just a moment too. So just for good luck here in the comments, IoT stuff doesn't interest me much. The pain that I'm having with IoT will probably interest you because people seem to like seeing me suffer if the tweets are anything to go by. And g'day to Nick in Bundaberg as well. So for the non-Aussies, Bundaberg is where the rum comes from. Now Nick is sipping coffee. He says it's coffee. But anyway, Bundaberg's where the rum comes from. So moving on. Couple of things here. Last week when I was doing this video, I got to about the 45-minute mark and my camera shut down. The bloody thing overheated. I've never seen that happen before. It's just like a warning on the screen, which was like too hot. And then the feed disappeared and the audio continued because I don't feed the audio through the camera. The audio just goes into a preamp, into USB, so audio survives when video dies. Now, a few people asked, they're like, how hot is it in there? So I do actually have a non-internet connected thermometer just here. And for those watching rather than listening, it is 23.7 degrees. It's cold. That's why I'm wearing I'm literally got my hacker hoodie today. So it wasn't that. There's a big screen behind it, the ultra wide, but it's not putting out too much heat. I did kind of wonder if it's the dummy battery. So a dummy battery, it looks like a normal battery, but is literally wired so that you can just keep power going the whole time and you're not just continuing to power on a battery on a camera. I've not seen it happen before. If it happens again, I'm going to have to start investigating further. But I got 45 minutes, which isn't too bad. So let's just see how it goes. Look at comments. Jason's in Melbourne. G'day. Good luck. Probably won't talk about what it's like here at the moment. Question from Steve. How did the Sony config to use the high temp setting? It's buried in the menus. Oh, did you set the config? No, I did not see that. I will make a note. You know what I'm going to do? I'm actually going to screen grab that comment so I can remember what happened later on. Oh, it's Lars. Lars is here. Haven't you got Llamas to watch? So for those of you who have not seen what Lars has done, and Lars, feel free to drop a comment in here, mate, with the link. Lars got a whole bunch of, first of all, Lars is a very good mate of mine. Lars got a whole bunch of Ubiquiti equipment. He lives in a farm in very rural Victoria. Whole bunch of Ubiquiti equipment, including cameras and a whole bunch of stuff that uplinks wirelessly. And he has a llama cam, which is a constant monitoring of his llamas across Ubiquiti equipment up into the cloud. And it is now viewable by all. So Lars obviously has too much time on his hands. Other things here. Look, I'll come back to the and Rambling Geek. Yes, it is an A6400 Sony, so I'm going to come back and sort that out and see what happened there. Question from Good Luck. What do you use for the screenshots? I use Print Screen Button. So I use a tool called Snagit from TechSmith. Now, I've probably been using Snagit for at least a decade. I'd say 15 years. So Tech Smith also make Camtasia, which is what I lived in for many, many years because all my Pluralsight courses were done with Camtasia. So Snagit's just super cool because it makes it very, very easy to do everything from like snip certain parts of the screen to snip it with the cursor, without the cursor, set a timer on it, capture short bits of video, pump them out as animated GIFs. And it is GIF, by the way. Let's not have this argument today. And then it has a little editor in it just for annotations and things. So Snagit is a really, really cool tool for that. So very happy with Snagit. Did you get rid of the sunburn? Troy, I don't know, was I looking orange? I haven't had much time in the sun. I did go wakeboarding. When do I do that? Friday. Yeah, because the last time I'd hit my head after I did that, so my head's better anyway. All right, on to other things, because I do have other things, and I'm going to do the cybery things first, and then I'll do the IoT things, because I could ramble on a bit about IoT. So here was something good. I shared this the other day. The BBC is now using pwned passwords. And in fact, Mark Burrows tweeted out, so this week we released a piece of work in the BBC account team, which had Troy Hunt's Have I Been Pwned password API and a registration process. Thanks for who helped with it. I wrote a blog post about how it works. Now, I did share that at the time, but just for anyone listening and interested, I will drop that blog post in the comments here as well. And it's just super, super cool to see the BBC use this. And in fact, whilst I'm talking about this, I'm going to fire up Cloudflare and see how many requests that API is doing these days. But, you know, the BBC is obviously just a massive brand. They have a huge audience that uses it. It's super, super cool that they're actually hitting the API as best I can tell. Of course, there's no author or anything like that. But, yes, they are using the API because they do talk about using k-anonymity and hash prefixes. They've got a nice flow chart about how k-anonymity works. It was a nice visual, actually. I like this. So they've written that up, and there's a little bit of information here about, you know, why should you use pwned passwords? Why should you check for people using previously breached passwords, which we would refer to as now known bad passwords? So good on the BBC for doing that. I'm just super, super happy that not only have they done it, but they've shared how they've done it publicly. And, you know, it's one thing for a modern tech company to share information about how they do the security things, for a more incumbent media company to share that sort of information is, I think, a very positive sign of the times. So I like them sharing that because hopefully others will see that and they'll do the same thing. And I also particularly like that this is just a free part of Have I Been Pwned without any API keys or anything like that. So let's have a look at my analytics. How am I going with pwned passwords? So requests. So in the last month, 743 million requests to pwned passwords. It looks like the single largest daily peak, and it does track very closely to the weekdays because inevitably it's a bunch of companies that people use, I guess, doing worky things that integrate. But the peak was 29.35 million requests in one day, which is fantastic. So, yeah, I'm super, super stoked to see that. Incidentally, also, Cloudflare gives you some little stats on the dashboard. It says, Cloudflare has helped me save 43 terabytes in the last month because Cloudflare also caches all the downloadable hashes just in case you want to run them offline. They're big. And if I had to serve 43 terabytes from Azure, I would get a very, very hefty bill from Microsoft. Very hefty bill. Egress bandwidth, not cheap. So big thanks to Cloudflare for that one. Now, other things. While I'm on Have I Been Pwned, I've had a couple of people ask how the open sourcing piece is going. So a couple of ways of answering this. First of all, going slowly. And part of the reason for that is because Have I Been Pwned, believe it or not, is still something that I have to try and do in my spare time. And I've been trying to fight with a lot of IoT stuff lately, so I haven't had a huge amount of spare time. But it is still something that remains a pet project, remains something that I have to do as there is available bandwidth. Now, it is a non-trivial exercise for multiple reasons. So, for example, what open source license should it be? Should it fit under, I'm going to be careful what I say now because I don't want to give away something which is really good progress. Should it fit under the banner of any other open source initiatives? And there is a direction that it's starting to head here, which I hope to be able to announce in the coming weeks. And then we get to things like, all right, well, have I been pwned? You know, we say it like it's one word, but it's many things. So I just talked about pwned passwords. That is a discrete project that sits in under the Have I Been Pwned website, but it is literally its own Visual Studio solution, its own storage constructs, its own Cloudflare account, its own domain. So, you know, that, to be honest, I think that is probably going to be the thing that just goes completely open source first, because it's so freaking simple to do it with. But then the other bits, it's like there is a website, and then separate to that, there are functions which do the APIs, and then separate to that, there are some of the enterprise-y bits which do some of the commercial things. And then they also have the government bits in there. And there's all of these different bits of the behemoth, which is Have I Been Pwned in terms of the logical components. The code itself is simple. There's basically nothing in the code. It's just tying all the bits together. So figuring out how to do it and to do it right remains the trick. And right will mean things like not just going, let's just make this repository public. Let's actually instead take out logical components, make sure there are no API keys or anything like that in there that shouldn't be there, and then probably go through a process where I have a smaller circle of people who I know and trust review the thing, and then we make it public and start taking contributions and everything. That then also impacts things like the deployment model, because at the moment it's all just Azure with Kudu compile and release on check-in to master. Like it is that simple for the website. It is, how do I do it with the API? For the API, I do have to go and manually trigger a build. And then for pwned passwords, I can't remember, because it's been like probably 18 months since I last deployed anything on pwned passwords. Point is, it impacts the build pipeline as well. So by going open source, it actually creates a lot of work to get to the goal from where it is now. It's not just like toggle the switch. Now, a few other questions coming up here. Speaking of cyber, are you still going to share how you helped get Raf's place online? Oh, okay. So Raf is my Italian mate who runs the restaurant. So there's a whole blog post there about doing a Ubiquity build out. That was actually, it's not a blog post. Well, there was a blog post, but there's a free series for Ubiquity as well. So all that's still relevant. So no changes there.
I'm sorry, I can't do that for you.
So weird. It always happens when I'm doing either videos like this or conference talks as well, which, of course, I don't really do anymore, not in the way we used to. Now, what else is here? Someone says, I know the company I work for has started checking passwords, don't actually know where they get the data from. There are, of course, multiple sources you could get passwords from. I am still probably more surprised than anyone that Have I Been Pwned seems to have become the most popular source for like passwords and breach data, because it wasn't the plan and we've just kind of accidentally ended up here. But yeah, I don't really care where you get it from. I think it's really good that the likes of Google and Apple and Microsoft are starting to build a lot of password validation stuff into browsers and into operating systems and checking against known bad lists. So I'm fine with all of that. Good Luck says, would you consider switching from Cloudflare to something else, or is Cloudflare the best option for your needs? They've been in some controversy. I personally don't like them. All right, so I'm going to actually ask why you don't like them, and then I'll talk about the controversy and we'll go down another rabbit hole. So I have no intention of switching. I've been using Cloudflare really extensively for a lot of years now, and I went to them originally because they made it so, so simple. In fact, this was at a point where Have I Been Pwned was getting hammered by some DOS style attacks, and I moved things behind Cloudflare and everything just stopped, and it was easy. And then I've used them time and time again, particularly as we started moving towards more HTTPS by default. It's like, this is the easiest way to get your static blog, for example, behind HTTPS. You literally just whack Cloudflare in front of it. And then we can have arguments about whether you're actually encrypting from Cloudflare all the way back to the origin or not. Totally different rabbit hole to go down there. But they made things very, very easy. Now, over the years, I've spent more and more time with people from Cloudflare. So, for example, the K anonymity implementation in Have I Been Pwned's Pwned Passwords was made by Junaid Ali. Now, Junaid is a top bloke, really, really smart guy. Someone I've spent a bunch of time with in person, in London, in San Francisco, in Sydney, all places I can't go anymore. And he's just like a genuinely nice guy. Like someone you want to go and have a beer with and spend some time with. And he's done some super, super smart stuff. A lot of it I think he ends up doing on his own time as well as Cloudflare's time as well, because he's just a passionate bloke. I've spent a bunch of time with other people there, including people like Matthew Prince, who's the CEO. And on many visits to San Francisco, I'd spend time with them. Or if I go to London, I'd go and see their CTO who's based there and just got to know a bunch of people there. And I appreciate that this is not the same sort of relationship that everyone can have, but the time that you spend face-to-face building rapport and relationships gives me a huge amount of confidence in who they are and what they do. It's one of the reasons I love the 1Password folks, because I've spent so much time with the people and it's not just a faceless enterprise selling a thing. Now, the controversy, and we'll see what Good Luck has to say about their own version of controversy or their interpretation of it. The controversy with Cloudflare often comes back to the fact that they're a reverse proxy. So Cloudflare doesn't, at least by any traditional means, and I think the term's a little bit liberal, they don't host your things. So they don't host Have I Been Pwned, they don't host TroyHunt.com, they don't host TroyHuntSucks.com. True story. All of those things sit on Azure. Actually, TroyHuntSucks.com sits on Azure, Have I Been Pwned sits on Azure, and TroyHunt.com sits on Ghost. And Cloudflare fronts it. So they take requests to, let's say, TroyHunt.com for the sake of simplicity, to TroyHunt.com. They either serve from cache from one of their 200-plus edge nodes around the world, or they go back to the origin and they retrieve from there. And then because they sit there in the middle of the traffic, they can do everything from inspect it for malicious activity and block it, which I don't care too much about for TroyHunt.com because it sits on Ghost. It's like that's their problem. It's not my problem. I care about it more for Have I Been Pwned. They can optimize the traffic. So you'll notice that even if you serve content, let's say just using gzip HTTP compression, if you sit behind Cloudflare, they can broadly compress it so long as they can serve it from their cache as well. So they can optimize that. They have other optimizations in there for bundling, minification, and all sorts of other things, image optimizations. So that they sit there and they do that, and they just sit in the middle going backwards and forwards. Now, the bit you can sort of argue about in terms of whether they're a host or not is that they are ultimately serving a bunch of content from their own infrastructure because it sits there in cache. This is part of the value proposition. But it's cache. It gets purged or it expires, then you have to go back to origin. If the origin website dies, the site that Cloudflare fronts basically dies. So eventually, once the cache gets purged. Now, the controversy is often, okay, what happens when, and this is the one that's come up the most. Let's say there's some right-wing extremist white supremacist bullshit website, and they're sitting behind Cloudflare. And you go, all right, first of all, screw that website because that's not the sort of thing that we want out there. Second of all, there's a really, really difficult discussion that's got nothing to do with Cloudflare now about free speech. And I appreciate I'm doing this in a time zone for the Americans. And I'm about to say the Americans get very, very particular about free speech and rights to free speech. Incidentally, the other parts of the world, well, we like the free speech thing as well. This is not just a constitution and amendment thing. But there is a very, very big debate around what free speech should you have. So should you be able to speak freely about things which might incite violence? Well, there's a lot of that throughout history. So it's like, no, you shouldn't, because we don't want people to be hurt. There is historical relevance as well. Now, I'm not going to try and take sides on this as well. I'm just trying to paint the picture of where the Cloudflare thing eventually comes back into it. One that's out there at the moment a lot is if anyone has heard of the conspiracy theory video about COVID-19 called Plandemic. Now, any reference to this conspiracy theory video, and I did watch it the other day just because I was curious, and it is batshit crazy. Anyway, okay, I do have a view on some of it. But it looks like any references to that are being put on Facebook are being pulled offline. Why? Because people are worried that if someone goes and watches this and then they effectively take medical advice from conspiracy theorists, you might die, and that is a bad thing. So there's always going to be censorship to some degree. Now, the difficulty of it comes in when you've got someone like Cloudflare who's not a host, they're a reverse proxy, and the site is operating legally, but we just, as a majority collective society, don't like what is on there, what should happen. And that the challenge that they often have is that some things will pop up which are recalcitrant by any reasonable measure, but legal. And it's like, well, should they then be the judge and the jury and they should pull the pin on it and kill it? And there are occasions where they have done that, often after receiving a lot of pressure to do that. Or should they adhere to the letter of the law and then forward on any legal requests that are sent to, intended to go to the original host of the site, which they do. And you end up in this situation where where they're stuck between a rock and a hard place because either they're censoring free speech and legally operating services or they're, on the other hand, white supremacist Nazis, depending on whose narrative you want to listen to. So that's the controversy I think that most often comes up, and it most often comes up with Cloudflare because they're the biggest. So I could go to another reverse proxy, and it is the same argument. There have been other reverse proxies, in fact, who some of these sites have migrated to after Cloudflare has dumped them. I'm trying to remember the name of it. Someone will know. There was one probably 18 months ago, and then they eventually just got taken offline because they're effectively getting to the point where they're just harboring hate speech. All right, that was a rabbit hole. I didn't expect to go down. I'm just going to look at some of these comments before I start really going down the rabbit hole with the IoT thing. Let's see. What was in here? Daniel, sadly, I only talked to some guys on Twitter so far. Graham, so Graham's the CTO. Justin, one of the security guys, and Matt have always responded to me a few times now. They all seem like great people from the limited experience I have with them. And this is something, it's getting warm in here now. This is something I think we all tend to forget a little bit, where we get online and we forget that there are real people behind all of these accounts. And I'm sure the way some people speak to me online, in fact, I know the way most people speak to me online when they're angry, they'd never do in person because it's never happened to me in person. Not just because I can't go anywhere, but it never happened before. And it just seems that when people get abstracted from personalities and they end up just communicating digitally, some folks really do lose their minds. Now, mind you, there are a bunch of people I've met in person in this industry who I don't really want to go and have beers or coffee with more than the once that I did. But Cloudflare blokes, always really, really good. Now, Sam, I like Cloudflare, but I'm scared of being too dependent on them with all my sites. I feel like I'm putting all my eggs in one basket. Love Workers as well, very impressive. I was actually just thinking of Workers when you said that. So for people who don't know what Workers are code on the edge. So if you imagine you're all around the world in different places now. If all of you go to troyhunt.com now, you will inevitably go to different edge nodes around the world. If I went there from here, I would go to the Brisbane edge node, and then I would possibly have my traffic routed back to the origin if it's not served from cache. So Workers are the ability to run code on the Brisbane edge node and the couple of hundred other edge nodes around the world. Now, a really good example of the sorts of stuff you can do with this. I found someone scraping all my blog posts. When was this? Probably about a week ago. Just scraping everything. And I wasn't very happy about this. And I noticed that they would scrape all the content, rehost the content, but then load the images off troyhunt.com. And it's like, oh, okay. So I have complete control over how the images on this blog are served. So I wrote a worker that looked for any request to images where the referrer was the domain name of this other website, and I just rickrolled them all. So now whenever you go and you look at this website, you just get rickrolled images. And this is what Cloudflare Workers are good for, rickrolling people. Also, Cloudflare Workers are very good for doing any other sort of manipulation of an inbound request or an outgoing response. So I use Workers a lot in different ways for things like when I rolled the Have I Been Pwned API over from the Azure web app service it was into Functions, I just use a worker to take the inbound request and send it to a completely different location. So it didn't break the contract for anyone. I use Workers in things like troyhunt.com to add security headers. So all of the CSP that you see in the header for troyhunt.com doesn't come from Ghost because they don't give you control over headers. Cloudflare injects it. So to the point back here about, where was it, Sam saying he's worried about putting all the eggs in one basket. In terms of being a reverse proxy, if I just literally turned off Cloudflare, then all the traffic would just start heading back to the origin. So long as I could serve a valid certificate from the origin, which you can do for free now on Azure, I would then have all of the traffic just served directly from the origin website. I could also go to another proxy. I think where I'd be more worried about the lock-in is, what about all of the firewall rules I've configured? What about the workers, which is the point you made? What about anything else which I have specifically configured on Cloudflare? So, yeah, there would be a migration path to take that and move to another provider. Now, would the potential for me to migrate later on be enough for me to say I don't want to go to Cloudflare at all because it means that I might have this work to do in the future if I decide to change? Well, no, because I get so much benefit from it. And this is what you're really trading off. It's like you don't have to use a reverse proxy. You can have a naked website, as they call it. But then you don't get any of these benefits and you get a whole bunch of other risks. So it's a trade-off. But in my view, at least, it's a very, very easy ROI to make. What else is on here? Lars and llamas. Disappointed that Lars didn't call the llama can the llamatron. Still time. Go and register that, Lars, before someone jumps on it. Jonathan, do you recommend using workers to add CSP, etc., headers to traffic versus a reverse proxy on the Origin server? I think there is a question to be asked around who is responsible for which parts of the infrastructure. So I'll give you a good example of where this used to go really wrong. And it was HPKP, so HTTP public key pinning, which we don't really do anymore. But I saw, because it's not supported by the browser anymore, because people kept screwing it up, I saw multiple cases where you have a development team responsible for the website. Now, the website serves the HTML. It also serves the response headers. And the response headers were how you added HPKP. You then have an infrastructure team responsible for things like the certificates on the website. Two different teams. Most of us probably know what it's like in big organizations and how well teams talk to each other. And I saw multiple cases where the developer team went, we're going to add HPKP. And HPKP would pin the public key of the certificate the website was returning, such that the browser came along, it got the certificate, it got the public key. If the public key in the header matched the one in the certificate, it would then pin that for a predefined period of time, possibly a year, into the browser. Then if the browser went back to the website at a later date and it got a different certificate, the connection would be refused and you couldn't load the content. I saw multiple occasions where the developers would pin the public keys or the certificates managed by the infrastructure team. The infrastructure team would then rotate the certificate at some time later on, and it would literally be HPKP suicide. Smashing Mag wrote a good story several years ago. And again, this is one of the reasons why we don't have HPKP anymore. About how they killed their website with HPKP. So getting back to the point about where we add headers, I'm worried about where there are two different teams responsible for code versus headers, and the two have to work well with each other. So if you were to say, look, I want to do it at the workers, so long as the people configuring it at the workers are also the people who are responsible for, at least communicate well enough with the people editing the web page, because remember, a CSP and the content of the web page have to work together. If someone goes and says, look, I want to start loading images in from another location and the content security policy blocks it, well, you're stuffed. Stuff just doesn't load. So I would probably say, this is what I do with Have I Been Pwned, load it from the origin, because the origin is loading the content. The origin loads the headers as well. The two work well together. So Have I Been Pwned, it's an ASP.NET MVC web app. It uses the nwebsec NuGet package, which makes it really easy to do CSPs by configuration. The only reason I do it on troyhunt.com with workers is because I can't modify the headers at the source. And if I could, I would. But here we are. Good luck. I don't like how Cloudflare is so easy to access for everyone. Yeah, accessibility sucks, man. Not really. A lot of illegal sites are protected by it. Well, they kind of shouldn't be. And there is an abuse process, and it's very, very well published. So if you do find an illegal website, use the abuse process in order to report that. There should be an application process to use Cloudflare, which would involve PII. I'm not sure why what PII would have to do with that. I suspect maybe where you're going there is that people should be forced to identify themselves in order to have a website. I think that is another rabbit hole to go down that I don't entirely agree with, particularly given the nature. Let's say it's there might be websites around political or religious views. Should we force people to be uniquely identifiable if they want to run that kind of website? I probably shouldn't ask that question because there's going to be strong views each way on it. Daniel says, if someone is abusing Cloudflare in an illegal way, you can report it to them, which is the point it's made. They'll also forward it to the service host. Cloudflare is meant to be easy for everyone to protect this service. One of the things we've got to remember with a discussion like this is that Cloudflare, I forget the stats exactly, so don't quote me on this, but it's somewhere in the tens of billions of requests a day and something like 30% of the internet's traffic. I mean, they are absolutely massive. They are ginormous. And there is this very, 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 very thin slice of shit that we would just prefer not to be on there. And the model that they've created has made it so accessible for everyone to get security via HTTPS, to get protection from DDoS, to get caching and optimized content, stuff that we all enjoy using. And it's done wonderful, wonderful things. But unfortunately, it is usually when there's something recalcitrant out there that's what gets the press, and that's what does tend to set our tone and expectation of a service. All right, let me move on past that, because I want to start talking about the IoT stuff, and I don't even know where to begin with this. What I can say is that I can now open my garage door with software, which is pretty, pretty cool. Now, I've got a lot of shit laying around on my desk here. All right, so I'm going to pick up something out of my cupboard, and this will explain why I'm so unhappy. All right, so all I wanted to do was open my garage door, and now I have a container full of wires and jumpers and PCBs and things like this. Now, IoT, I'm going to upset some people here. IoT at the moment is a real maker world. And what I mean by that is, like, it's one thing to go, oh, I've got some Philips Hues and I plug them in and I can use my phone to turn them on and off. And that's fantastic. That's lovely. But when you get to the point where you go, yes, but I would like my Philips Hues to turn on and off based on motion via a motion sensor, like this is an Akira motion sensor. Well, now you've got a problem. Because as far as I know, you can't do it with HomeKit, which is built into the Apple ecosystem, which I'm well and truly embedded into. Maybe you can do it with Google Home. Maybe you can do it with Alexa. Maybe there's something else very consumer-centric on the shelf out there that can help you do that. But it's an absolute piecemeal approach because there's so many different things that work in some places but not in other places. And when I got to the garage door, this was about 125 days ago now. So I've been going down this past like 4 months. It seemed kind of simple because the garage door has a 12-volt connection, so two wires into a terminal block for 12 volts. It also has another 2 points on a terminal block where if you close the circuit, the door will open. So there are aftermarket products you can buy that integrate into that. But it was like, okay, how do I actually make this work with my ecosystem? And this is what started taking me down the Home Assistant route. So Home Assistant, not to be confused with HomeKit, is the free open source, very often run on a Raspberry Pi home automation product, which is enormously powerful and very often frustrating. I'll come back to that. The garage door thing, the popular consensus was either some consumer off-the-shelf stuff, which was not only very expensive, but frankly, very often very crap. In fact, one of them I was looking at, my mate Ken from Pentest Partners did end up writing up later on, it had some serious vulnerabilities. But one of the most popular ways is to use a Sonoff SV. So this is a Sonoff SV. This was about seven US dollars or something, so cheap. So it's like, okay, this is good. Now, how do you plug this into your garage door? So first of all, you got to flash it. You got to flash it with Tasmota. Now, to flash it with Tasmota, a couple of different ways to do it. Tasmota's custom firmware. You can get an Arduino. This is not even the right words for it. I'm literally lost for words about the freaking stuff I bought. You can use the Arduino, basically software development kit. You get one of these little sort of USB to serial style connectors like this. You get some sticky tape, masking tape like this. You wire everything up in the right order so that you make sure that you get the 3.3 volt to the 3.3 volt, and then you connect it like that. And then you've got to get transmit on one going to receive on the other because sometimes they flag them differently. And then you flash the firmware onto the – all I want to do is open my garage door. Now, after you've done all that, you will need to do some soldering, which for reasons I still can't understand, every time I say it in any American videos, it sounds like soldering. Anyway, it's soldering. I'm not the one with the accent. Do some soldering and you solder some more jumpers onto here. And then you wire that up. And then you go into your reflashed software and you configure what the other jumpers do because a whole bunch of people then connect them to read through. And it was about here I lost my shit because I'm like, all I want to do is open my freaking garage door. Why am I ending up flashing custom firmware onto physical devices? So I'm going to pause there for a second to calm down a little bit and catch my breath. And I can see a bunch of comments and things going here as well. And I'm going to just stick to the IoT stuff for the moment. IoT, the S is for security. Yes, we've heard this many times before. I am going to get to the security side of things as well. Is actually useful about opening a garage door software. Okay, so here's this is actually a very good question. And I think we've got to not lose sight of why are we doing these IoT things? Because is it because you want to be a geek or is there a functional benefit? Easy answer. So I have two garage doors. So there's one which is on the outside of the house and there's a wall around the house. You can climb over the wall. The kids used to be able to slide through a gap in the wall. It's quasi-private. And behind there, there's like a carport with open sides because people looked at the video and they're like, why do you have a locked door in front of something where the sides are open? And then there's another garage door behind that, which then is sort of like part of the house. And that's where I've got other valuables and things like that. So what I'm trying to do is actually automate the front one. And one of the reasons for it is I go out and I ride my bike a lot. And I'd like to be able to, as I'm riding home, on my watch, just go yoink, yoink like this. And the door opens and I don't have to take all the keys and stuff out of my pocket. And then I get access back into the house. So there is a real functional value to it. I'd also like to be able to do things like if I am out and someone comes to deliver a package and they call up, and this does happen a bit in Australia, I don't know if it happens other places, and they say, we'd like to leave you the package, is this somewhere safe? I can go, yeah, no worries, mate, let me press the button, and the garage door opens, they drop the package off. I do have a read switch, and incidentally, a read switch is just like a magnetic switch, can tell you when two things are close to each other, so I can tell me when the door's open or not. And I've got Ubiquiti security cameras, so I can see them drop it off, and then I can remotely close the door again, job done. So this is the functional value proposition. Whether you're a techie or not, this just makes sense. So the question here is, how much are you actually going to use that? I would use it a lot. I would use it every day, multiple times. Wouldn't it be quicker just to hit the switch? That I have two remotes at the moment. They cost a lot. They have to be programmed into that garage door. There's one in each car. There's not one in my tennis bag when I ride my bike down to tennis, for example. So there's lots of use cases for it. Just put on a separate VLAN, it's fine. There's a whole other story about how painful that is. let me have a look. Someone else has got the UAG watch strap. Good stuff. I still love this. It's really good. I'm going to go wakeboarding later on. I appreciate this every time I do that. Frustrating stuff, telco routers. Troy, do you get a notification if you leave the garage door open? Now, very, very good question. So this is one of the things that I do have working. So the read switch I mentioned, it's a very, very simple binary sensor. Either the magnet is close to the other switch, which is when the door's closed, or the magnet is not close to it, which is when it's open. So you've got this binary sensor, and this starts to sort of take us into the discussion of where is the value proposition for Home Assistant. You have all of your connected things. So your read switch, my phone is a connected thing that can sense to see if my phone is in the house or not. The little temperature sensors I have everywhere. This thing that doesn't work is a vibration sensor. I've got to figure out why it doesn't work. Plan was to put this under the letterbox so I get a notification when it's open, so I know there's mail. The lights I'll talk about in a moment, and the Shelly's, which I'll also talk about in a moment. All these things in your house. Now, they can all act as, well, many of them can act as sensors. The light is not a sensor, obviously, but then there are things which are not necessarily physical devices in your house but are still considered sensors. So, for example, is it raining or not based off the Bureau of Meteorology? Is it sunset? Is it sunrise? So one of the things that I did do is occasionally I have forgotten to close the outdoor garage door. Now, not a massive problem, but every now and then there are some break-ins and I want people wandering around the outside of the locked house. So if the sun sets and the garage door is still open, my Sonos downstairs speaks and it says, hey, you've left the garage door open. One of the things I'm also going to do is just get one of the connected lights to start flashing red to indicate that there is a status which needs to be inspected. So that's a really good example of where there is something practical and useful. Okay, so that is that. Vids, I feel your pain. Thank you. All right, so let me move on. Now, I don't want to be disingenuous to people that like soldering and reflashing hardware and drivers and things like that, because this is a lot of fun for a lot of people, and we all have our things that we enjoy geeking out on. But the thing that was just really starting to bug me is this assertion that to make basic shit work in your IoT world, you need a soldering iron. Like that was just starting to me, it just didn't sit well. Same again with reflashing. And I know Tasmota, you can do a bunch of stuff with that, but things like the Shellys, which I'm going to talk about more in a moment, they do have pretty good software built into it. Now, someone made a comment on Twitter the other day. I said, I want to reflash it with Tasmota because it's open source and I want to know what it does. The only thing worse than having to go through and reflash devices with custom firmware is then having to go through and read the bloody software with the expectation that, A, you'll actually understand all of whatever code it's written in, and B, you'll be able to go through and identify any security bugs. I just want to open my garage door. I don't want to audit someone's code. So let's talk about the Shellys, because the Shellys are really cool. Now, the reason I started looking at the Shellys is because of these things just here. Now, this, I have since learned, is unfamiliar to some people. So let me talk about the joy, both the joy and the pain of these, like literally physically pain. The joy of them is these are downlights. So normally they'd sit up in your ceiling like this, and they sit flush with the ceiling there. That's a 92-millimeter diameter hole. It's very, very standard. You can go into any lighting shop in Australia and buy dozens and dozens of different types of these, both internet-connected or not internet-connected. And then if you want to change them at any time, see, they've got just a normal Aussie plug on the end. So I literally go up to the roof, I pop it out of the roof, pull the plug out, put another one in. Don't need an electrician to do it because it's just a normal power socket. At the other end of this is obviously a female connector that one goes into. Now, eventually, I will replace everything in the house with these, not necessarily all internet connected, and I'll come back to that, but with these, and they'll replace all of the halogen lights that are in the house at the moment. And the reason for that is that halogens, where do you start with all the problems there? They burn really hot, apparently responsible for a lot of fires. They use a lot of electricity. They blow really, really frequently. I am perpetually replacing halogens, partly because I have literally 130 halogens throughout the house. Like, it's a large house, but there's a lot of them. Some of the ceilings are really high too, and I can't even get to there. You need a, you know, someone with a big ladder. They're an absolute pain in the ass, and they're also, I don't know if I have any laying around here, they also sit in like a silver, these particular ones sit in a silver frame. They just don't look nice against the white roof. So this is what will go in there. The pain, the physical pain, is that every one of these has two built-in mouse traps, and they work like this, all right? So here's the idea. You put this up in the ceiling, you pull back these two hinges, okay? So you pull back the hinges like that. They go up into the roof, and then the hinges come down, and they hold that flush. Now, what happens is when you pull them out, see, the hinges go like that, and then I did it very gently because it hurts like a bastard. They literally snap like a mousetrap on your fingers. So you've got to try and make sure you get them on the right side. But then what happens is when these come out, they pull the little rubber feet off like that. So I think it's a bit of a screwy design flaw. So anyway, these are awesome. Now, you can get these not internet connected. Most of the ones out there are not internet connected. Many of them have a physical switch for three different light warmth. So you can decide how warm you want your light to be as a normal layperson just by pulling the thing out, flicking it. It's not like a dimmer where you're changing it every day. It's like you try and get this right and then you leave it and you probably don't change it again, but you've got a bit of configurability. So there's that. You can obviously get ones that are dimmed as well, or you can get ones like this, which are internet connected. So these do connect over Wi-Fi. You can get other ones that connect over Zigbee. These ones are, as you can see on the back, they're smart downlights. Got to put it in my face so it focuses. Smart downlights, which is much better than the dumb ones. And, of course, there are many different types of smart downlight. So the ones I have on my roof at the moment, if I tilt the camera up, you'll see there's going to be one up there. So there's a blue one there, and I made that one pink just because it matches the Philips Hues, that Philips Hue Goes that are sitting on my desk at the moment. And those ones are a bit painful for a few reasons. They've got the entire control unit, and it does run an ESP chip as well for the more IoT-centric folks out there. But it's got a entire big, fat control unit that sits on here. These actually have them built in. These ones as well, they lose state. So every time you kill the mains power, maybe you got the exact perfect combination of RGB on that light, and then you kill the mains power, and the state goes. You turn it back on, and now it's white again. this maintained state, which is really good. This one I actually like a little bit more because if you look at it sideways like this, it sits pretty flush like that. Those ones are a little bit, they've got a little bit of a bezel, comes out of that. Anyway, those ones were, they're Atom lights. In fact, they're these ones right here. So they look just like that. And they were like $43 each or something. And these ones were $35 Aussie dollars. Take away about a quarter if you want to get USD. So relatively affordable, these ones. The other thing is, compared to the halogens, because they have a really, really, really long lifetime, is that, yeah, they're a bit more expensive, but I'm not going to have to keep replacing the whole time too. So the first part of the challenge is, this is a great light. It's IoT controllable in the roof. That's fantastic. Now, what happens when my mum and dad come around? So here's what I mean by this. My mum and dad are very good with using light switches. They've had a lot of experience toggling the light switches on and off. Less so good controlling lights with a phone. So one of the things which has probably made my life harder than what it should have been, but I think it's going to have a better result, is that I do not want to have a home that you need to be a geek in order to use simple functions on. Everything that's important in the home for a normal everyday person to be able to use still has to work the same way, which means regardless of how the internet connected light is turned on, you must always be able to turn it off with a switch. If it is off, you must always be able to turn it on with a switch. Absolutely non-negotiable. But how do you do that? Because those ones there and these ones here, I can turn them on and off either on the switch because it kills the mains, or I can turn them on and off with the app. Now, what happens if I've turned them off at the mains because mum and dad have been here and they use that switch, and then I have some sort of an automation that tries to turn them on, but they've literally got no power running to them? Doesn't work. That's where the Shelly comes in. So the Shellys, now these were, I think it was about 25 Aussie dollars. They are approved for use in Australia as well. Now, Australia, we've got to be careful because we do have different laws to other parts of the world because Australia, so I'm not entirely sure why we have some of the ones we do, but part of those laws mean that you cannot go and fit these yourself into a 240-volt power supply. You can in a 12-volt power supply, which is what I've done in my garage door, but if you want to plug these into mains, you need a Sparky, which for foreigners is an electrician. Now, fortunately, I have a good one, a bloke who has seen my vision of IoT and is helping. And the value proposition of these Shellys is that, as you can see, they're very small. You can fit them behind most light switches, depending on how large your cavity is. You can wire your physical light switch into this such that your physical light switch can change the power state of whatever the light condition is at the moment, and a digital switch can also change the light condition. So this gives you the best of both worlds. It also means that you can use normal lights that don't have to be IoT, and you can use normal light switches that don't have to be IoT. So I could go into, say, my master bedroom, which has a roof full of halogens and just normal flicky switches, put one of these behind, hey presto, you're now internet connected. And it's cheap. So this is why I bought only five of them the other day, but I bought five Shellys. I've put one in the garage door. I'm going to get the Sparky to put the other ones in a room that I'm doing some work on at the moment. And I'll share all of this later on as it gets finished. So these seem to be the best of both worlds. I'm very, very excited about these. Now, one of the things is I am going to start getting a lot of IP addresses. And people have gone, what about like IP address exhaustion? Well, I can always put it on a different subnet. Like that's fine. I can put things on different subnets. In fact, as it is, every IoT device goes onto a different Wi-Fi network. I've not VLAN'd them at the moment. I had my previous Ubiquiti network VLAN'd, and it is a constant pain in the ass simply because you get things like the Sonos, which need to multicast from the VLAN IoT network back into the primary network, causes all sorts of problems. The pairing process is often painful as well. Now, whether you have it VLAN or not, you've got the same problem. But very often, the device which is doing the pairing needs to be on the same network as the device you are pairing. So I find myself constantly putting my phone on the IoT network in order to pair an IoT device. So there are some little barriers and things like that. But I'll keep putting them on a different Wi-Fi network because it's going to make it much easier later on. Wi-Fi network, a different IoT network. It'll make it much easier later on for me to put it on a different subnet, or if I do want to VLAN it, or if I want to put any other controls around that other network. Now, of course, you do need networking infrastructure that allows you to do that, and a lot of consumer-grade stuff is not going to. It's one of the reasons I like the Ubiquiti stuff. And I wonder if Lars is still there with his Llama Cam. But Ubiquiti make really, really good prosumer equipment as well. So something like a Dream Machine, you can either get the Dream Machine, which is the consumer grade one, sits on your desk, or there is a Dream Machine Pro, which is a rack mounted one, which is what I got downstairs. They will allow you to create separate VLANs and separate Wi-Fi networks and all that sort of thing. All right, so I'm going to pause and have a look at the comments for a moment. More people feeling my pain. So this is like, this sums it up. So someone with an acronym I can't pronounce here says, yep, went down the same rabbit hole with Sonoff and Tasmoto. I enjoyed it for the first 30 minutes. After that, I just wanted something out of the box. And honestly, like, this is where I got to. I wasn't in a good way yesterday. And I basically got to the end of the day and I went, I have done no actual work. I still can't do anything more than what I was able to do before. And I'm just pissed off. And I just, anyway, this is just not what I wanted. Now, Sam says it's not about, this is obviously a comment about open source. It's not about me auditing the code. It's about other people having the ability to do it for me and the community. Oh, like OpenSSL did. Ooh, too soon. I'm obviously very supportive of the whole idea of open source, but I'm also not of the view that just by making something open source, you somehow magically solve these problems. And I'm also not of the view that software that might not be open source and might be proprietary, might be closed, I'm not of the view that that is inherently vulnerable in any way. This often comes up with 1Password, where people say, I wouldn't use 1Password because it's not open source. I'd only use like KeePass. It's like, okay, but 1Password has had like really extensive audits. They've got really, really good development teams. They've got a really, really good track history of not having the sorts of vulnerabilities you'd worry about with a password manager. This is not just a Boolean black and white. It's like closed source, bad, not inspectable, has problems, open source, all everyone can read it, they will, and it will all be okay. It's not that at all. And I think everyone's got to recognize that there is a continuum and a spectrum there. And frankly, I think one of the most valuable things with the open source bit is, as I hope to do with Have I Been Pwned, that the contributions and the evolution of the product, not just the ability for other people to read it, and certainly not just making the assumption that just because it is readable by other people, they will read it and they will find the bugs. Now, that said, I am happy with the software on here. It does have a RESTful API, so you can make HTTP requests. At the moment, I've got Postman open here. I can go to Postman, make a request, and open my garage door. Yay. I have not yet worked out how to make an HTTP request from a Home Assistant automation. To me, that should be really simple, but I know I've got to set something up in configuration.yaml, and now we go back down the rabbit hole again. Other people say I should just set it up using MQTT and actually have message queues. I had problems getting MQTT to work. And you're just tying together all of these things, which in fairness do seem to be stable when you get them working. But you're still tying together a lot of very, very manual things. Are these smart lights for switches that maintain on-off state? I think I kind of covered that after blackout. In Venezuela, we have very short blackouts and brownouts very frequently. So these are the ones that maintain the state. Now, incidentally, these are basically no-name brand, but I'm pretty sure they do run ESP chips as well. But I wanted to get different types in order to see things like that, state maintenance. In fact, yesterday I had one of these just here and I had the other one in the other socket, and I did some video about how they behaved. The one thing that I've done to overcome the state problem with these ones is that for my office, there's only two ways that these lights get turned on. One way is the little sensor that I spoke about before. So this is a motion sensor where, in fact, it's a motion and a light sensor. And if the light is beneath a certain level and it detects motion, when I come in, the two Philips Hue Go's on the desk light up, the Philips light strip, Hue light strip under the desk lights up, and these light up as well. And not only do they light up, but they get set to an RGB and a brightness state. And the same thing happens with the little button on my Stream Deck. So I've got a button I can press here. Things will go darker for a moment, like that. When I hit the button again, it fires an automation. The automation doesn't just turn on, it sets state. I'm okay with that for my office, but that's not what I want in other parts of the house. So in other parts of the house, I'm just going to want to have power switches on and off. So these are okay because they're always triggered by Home Assistant, and I can get away with that. In fact, because they're always triggered by Home Assistant, I really don't even need one of these in the wall because I can just turn that on and off. digitally. Did you buy Shelley from an Australian distributor? Yes, I did. And I found a really good one too. I'm super, super happy with these. So this company is called OzSmartThings.com.au. So that's OzSmartThings.com.au. The reason I'm super happy is because I ordered two of the downlights, five of the Shelleys. They arrived within about 48 hours up here on the Gold Coast. So that was pretty quick. I got a personal email from them as well saying, hey, look, you know, thanks very much for buying it. It felt personal. Maybe it wasn't, but it did a good enough job of feeling personal. So that was really good. And I think I'm going to buy a lot more stuff from them. Those RGB downlights, they're $35 each, including GST. But you can also buy, you can buy them in four packs for quite a bit less. I think it was something like $120 for a four pack. And once you're getting down to that price, it's like, yeah, that's pretty good. And I don't care that they're no-name brands because they seem to be pretty stable. So I'm going to put these in the kids' rooms and I'm going to integrate that into their existing automation. So they've got light sensors there as well, which turn all sorts of things on, as well as making the Amazon Echoes on their desks send them welcome messages and things like that, which is a bit of geeky fun. But yeah, I'll put these on the roof too. So Dave Lee, I had the same problem with Alexa not being able to connect to things across VLANs. Seems like a good idea, more trouble than it's worth. And it's just constantly painful. And what gets me as well is I was continually ending up where something wasn't working quite right. And I'm like, all right, is it the VLAN? Is it the VLAN or has it just dropped off the network? Is it something to do with the Wi-Fi? Is there an internet service it can't reach? I was continually questioning the reliability of that VLAN configuration and it was just painful. Now, Roger says, this is why I'm doing Z-Wave and Zigbee over Wi-Fi devices. So there is a bit of a philosophical discussion here around, do I want to have, let's say for argument's sake, I replaced every single freaking downlight in this house and I now have 130 of these on the roof. Incidentally, this is such a weird house. Like it's a lovely house, but it'd be things like there's a little area outside the kids' room that must be about, let's call it 4 meters by 3 meters, right? Like a little alcove area. And there are four lights on the roof, four lights in this tiny, tiny little area. Now that's weird enough, but then there are two different switches because you need to be able to turn on the two lights against the back wall separately to the two lights that are literally only about a meter and a half away from there. So you end up with four lights and two circuits. And more importantly, four holes in the roof. So I can take some away, but now I've got holes in the roof. Anyway, so imagine I have 130 IP addresses in the house for these, and then I've got maybe another 20 IP addresses there for these. So I've got 150 IP addresses or something. And there is the discussion about having all these different IP addresses and possible IP address exhaustion, which, again, I don't really think is an issue. Or should you use something like Zigbee? So, for example, the Philips Hues work over Zigbee. Now, they either Zigbee back to a Philips Hue hub, and Zigbee is a wireless protocol which is highly efficient, is used on a lot of IoT devices. All of these little things use Zigbee as well. They've got a native wireless mesh implementation as well. So when you have other powered Zigbee devices in the house, they will act as repeaters. So the three Philips units I've got here are not connected to the Philips hub. They're connected to a Zigbee sniffer. So I now have an even bigger like wireless Zigbee mesh. So that's kind of neat. And then you don't have all the same IP addresses and things like that. I'm just not sure that it really provides a lot of value for powered devices that aren't just working off those little CR, whatever, flat batteries, which need to be very, very low power. I actually like the fact that things like this are addressable over IP because it makes it very easy for me to do things like if I do want to create an automation directly against a RESTful API. So that's my view of it. I'm going to end up with a little bit of both. You need to have WAF, which is built into things like Ubiquiti. What else in here? Are we going back down the password route there? Dave Lee, I want to do exactly the same with my lights, but no neutrals at the light switch in the UK home. So Shelley's behind light switches isn't an option. I need to understand a lot more about how lights work to understand why that's not an option as well. Main thing I have issues with is different protocols, Zigbee, Z-Wave, MQTT, etc. So this is a comment from Sam. And you're right, mate. This is painful, figuring out all the different bits and how everything needs to work together. Look, Z-Wave and Zigbee, to the best of my knowledge, are equivalent in many ways, and then that is obviously in parallel to doing things over Wi-Fi. I think the reality of it is that you're going to end up with a bunch of stuff spread across different means of communication, and I don't know that that's really a bad thing. I think it's okay that I talk to these over IP, and it's okay I talk to those over Zigbee. Well, WAF is WAF accepted, accepted functionality. Well, I think this sort of comes back to the point about, can normal people use the environment? So I don't want a situation where anyone else comes into the house. I mean, let's say I've got a babysitter over to look after the kids one night. I want them to be able to turn on the TV, for example. Now, I mean, this is another rabbit hole. How many times do you walk into someone's house, probably your own house, and you look at the coffee table and say, wow, there are 6 remote controls here. And you need to get the input right on that one, and then you do the volume with that one and everything else. And then you go, oh, no worries. I will fix this by having a universal remote control, which incidentally, I just ordered another Logitech Harmony that should come today, and I'll talk about that in a moment too. And then you go, okay, cool, now I've got this universal remote control. It fixes everything. Well, it doesn't have the motion sensor that's in the Apple 4K TV remote control, and you use the motion sensor for games. And also that has a microphone in it so that you can do voice control. So now you're going to have at least 2 remote controls anyway. On that remote control piece, because I'm replacing a receiver, which just wasn't powerful enough to drive the speakers I have, and it just took me about 10 years of having the old receiver to realize that, and as part of some renovations I'm doing, I decided to get a new universal remote. I did have a Logitech Harmony, an earlier generation one, which mostly worked most of the time, but I just found was a little bit too glitchy too much of the time. So I went down the other rabbit hole of trying to find another universal remote control and ending up with a newer version of the Harmony, which is what should come today, because consistently, it's just really hard to find a good universal remote control at a reasonable price as well. And the Logitech Harmonies are really reasonably priced. And they ultimately end up being one other remote control controlling a Wi-Fi connected device, which you can also control from here and integrate into things like Home Assistant. So I might talk about that more next week after the thing. Actually, I probably won't even set up next week. I'm going to wait for the new receiver to arrive and then get everything set up together. All right, so look, I think that that's mostly it. My goal today, in fact, what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to Tatham Oddie. Now, I shared a blog post from Tatham a couple of days ago. Tatham is a mate of mine down here in Australia. He's another sort of prominent bloke in tech circles who is ridiculously smart at making IoT stuff work. And after he obviously saw my frustration tweeting the other day, he had some ideas. And I said, I think we're going to be getting a screen sharing session on Teams at the moment, because it's one of these things where we've all been here, right? Probably on both sides, where you're trying to fix a problem, you're banging your head against the wall for hours. Someone who actually knows what they're doing comes along and goes, oh, here, you haven't connected the green wire to the red wire or something like that. And then bang, the problem solved. I need to do better at failing early and asking for help to fix this stuff. So I might try and get in touch with Tatham today and maybe eventually get my garage door connected to Home Assistant. Okay, so thank you very much for watching. I made it just over an hour without the camera dying as well. So I'm going to wrap it up there. And next week, we'll just see how much of this stuff is actually still working. And hopefully I haven't like electrocuted myself or anything like that. But my hope is that I do have a bunch of both these things in the house and working. And I know it's not directly InfoSec related, but we can talk more about that next week. Thank you very much for watching. Hope you have an awesome day wherever you are in the world. See you, folks.